Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and we have such a cool and special show for you this week. I got the chance to talk to writer-director Eric England about his new movie, Contracted. It's a horror movie that came out last year, and I have been sort of singing the praises of it all over fthismovie.net in the last few weeks. A listener actually heard the show, Philip Blade, B-L-A-D-H, and it turns out that he was the sound mixer on the movie, and so he sent me an email to fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com and said, hey, just so you know, I worked as the sound mixer for the movie, and I'm actually really happy to hear you talking about it. If you would be at all interested, I could perhaps put you in touch with Eric England, who wrote and directed the movie. And I said, yes, absolutely. And so he did, and I got the chance to talk to Eric England, and we just had a great conversation about the making of his movie, the themes in his movie, the approach that he took. Then it kind of branches off from there. We talk about just horror movies in general, and it's a ton of fun. He's a super cool, laid-back guy, and the hour was over before I knew it. Just so you know, before you listen to this podcast, please make sure that you watch Contracted. It's currently available on Netflix Instant. Or you could just go ahead and buy the DVD from Amazon or download it from iTunes. We spoil the movie right off the bat, and it's the kind of movie that you're better off going in unspoiled. So make sure that you watch the movie before you listen to our conversation. And everybody should check out Eric England on Twitter. He's Eric_England on Twitter. And Philip Blade, who was the sound mixer and kind of made this interview happen, is actually the producer of an independent movie right now called Geek USA that's looking for distribution and playing some festivals. And you can check that out at geekusafilm.com. And you should check out his website, bladesound.com, B-L-A-D-H sound.com. And see everybody, if you want to get your own personal plug on the show, you just have to hook me up with a filmmaker that I really, really like. So thank you again to Philip Blade for making this happen. Thank you so much to Eric England for being a great guy and making a really kick-ass movie. You should check out his other movies also. Roadside, which is currently coming perhaps to a theater near you, and Madison County. And you should all check out Contracted. Thank you very much for making this cool movie, and thank you guys all for listening. It's really great to talk to you. I really, really, really love your movie.
Thank you so much. No, thank you for having me. My my sound mixer, Phil, is like a big fan of y'all's, and he actually mentioned to me that he heard you talking about the film on the podcast, and he was like, man, that's so great. Like, he was just so excited to hear you guys were talking about it because, you know, Phil was really excited to work on the film. So I appreciate you guys reviewing the film and digging it.
Yeah, no, it's really awesome. My plan is before this conversation, I'm actually going to record just a little introduction where I announce that the conversation is probably going to have spoilers in it, because I feel like to really talk about the movie, I think people really need to see it first, because I don't want to give certain things away until people have seen it. So if it's okay, we can kind of talk spoilery.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you saying that. You're actually the first person that I've ever talked to that wants to do that, because most people, you know, they kind of just I don't know if they just expect me to kill it for everyone, or if they just try to dance around it. But no, I appreciate that. That make it a lot easier to talk about, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure in a review situation, obviously you don't want to give certain things away, but the movie's been out for a little while and people are really starting to see it with it being on Netflix and everything, and so I feel like, you know, I really want to have a conversation about it. So I guess I'll start really with the major spoiler, which is when I watched the movie, I was really digging it as kind of just this body horror, very sad, very kind of scary descent into hell that this girl's going through. Yeah. And then I get to those last 5 minutes. And where is that? Was that the jumping off point for you? Did you kind of come up with the end first and decide to work? Okay, so maybe I'm crazy. This is sort of like a prequel to a zombie movie, correct?
Absolutely, and that's absolutely the jumping off point. I mean, essentially, when I was coming up with the idea for the movie, I've always wanted to do a zombie movie. In fact, like, I kind of have this weird thing where I as much as possible, I want to try and work in as many of the defined subgenres that horror has to offer, but I don't want to do what we've seen a million times, you know? So I've talked with people in the past and they've asked me things like, you know, what would you do if you did a zombie film? So for me, it's like, I didn't want to do something that was like, oh, the world has ended and it's the apocalypse and zombies roam the earth. So I was like, how would I do that differently? And my idea was to start from the beginning. And I was like, you know, I'm more fascinated by where zombies come from and how they start and what that initial kind of, you know, conception is. And essentially, I was really interested in doing a film that was like relatable, you know?
Yeah.
So I was thinking of like things that would be terrifying to me. And I think everyone can relate with being terrified that their body's kind of turning against them, you know? So it's weird because a lot of people ask me, they're like, you know, are you a big body horror fan? And I am, but I think body horror has a tendency to get very gratuitous and very exploitative. And, you know, and for me, it's like I wasn't interested in doing that. I was more interested in telling a story about a girl who contracts an STD or what she thinks is an STD and is actually slowly turning into a zombie. And, you know, I think by nature that just kind of turns itself into a body horror film, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. How important to you was it to sort of have it be a reveal at the end of the movie? Because it really doesn't necessarily tip its hand, at least the first time you watched it. I rewatched the movie again last night and I was amazed knowing what I knew now, how many sort of signifiers there are that this is exactly what's going on. And I missed it the first time because maybe my mind is just at body horror, and now watching it again, I'm like, no, this is totally a zombie movie.
Yeah. It's weird. And I appreciate that. I'm glad it kind of holds up. You know, it's weird. For me, the reveal was one of the biggest factors for me, because I didn't want to like give it away too much, you know?
Right.
But it's funny because I showed the movie early before we released in theaters. We had a screening at USC in LA, and it was funny because the program actually mentioned that the film is a zombie film. And while I was doing the Q&A, I was being very, you know, vague, and then I was like, you know, I didn't want to tell people, you know, from the get go that this was a zombie film. And then one of the people in the audience like raised their hand and they were like, actually, I knew it was a zombie movie going in. And I was like, really? How did you know? And they were like, well, it says right here on the like pamphlet.
Oh, man.
And everyone in the audience just kind of collectively started nodding like, yeah, they marketed this as like a new take on the zombie film. And I was like, wow, that's awful. But I was like, like 99% of the audience stayed for the Q&A. And I was like, so you guys dug the movie, even though they were like, yeah, man, it was great. So like, surprisingly, the movie still worked for a lot of people who go into it knowing what it is. But for me, you know, I think it was one of those things, like, to be completely honest with you, I wasn't sure of how well received the film was going to be, because for me, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but this was the smallest movie I've ever made. I had the lowest budget. I had the least amount of time. And it was really just blood, sweat, and tears and pure creativity making this film. So in all respects, the film was an experiment, you know. So I going into it, I was like, man, I don't know if people are going to understand this film, you know. Like I thought they were going to see it as kind of this weird drama about this girl's body falling apart, you know. And the reveal at the end, you know, even though it was always the idea, you know, people who don't really pay attention to the movie, and unfortunately, that's kind of the world we live in today. You know, it's like I'm fully aware that there are people who watch this movie on Netflix while they're making dinner and you know, texting their friends and shit. So, you know, it's like a lot of people miss the subtle details, like you said, that you noticed the second time around. So some people actually think the ending was kind of like an afterthought or a cop-out. You know what I'm saying? They look at, like, her ripping her fingernails off and her teeth falling out and the maggots and all that stuff. Like, they look at it as just pure exploitation, like I said earlier, you know, that they've come to expect in the horror genre. But the idea was to hopefully, you know, put those strategically in place in the narrative to where it's almost leaving you a trail of breadcrumbs to where, you know, at the end of the movie, you're like, oh, if you've been paying attention, it's a nice reveal, you know. But a lot of people kind of either overlook it or miss it. But, you know, it's nice because that was the idea, was to leave the breadcrumbs and hopefully, you know, if people caught on that, you know, it kind of it either tipped them a little earlier, or, you know, it's nice when people realize it on that last shot of the movie when she wakes up in the car, you know. But it's really unique how people, you know, a lot of people have told me, they're like, man, from the poster, it gives it away, like she's a zombie. But they're like, the whole time I'm watching the movie, I'm not thinking zombie until the last shot of the movie.
Yeah, that's exactly how it worked. That's exactly how it worked on me.
Cool. Well, that's great, because I mean, honestly, that was like my intention deep down in my gut, but I didn't know if it was going to be as, you know, as effective as I wanted. And honestly, yeah. I don't really have a reason for why I don't, you know, because that was one of my biggest fears, was when we were shooting the movie and she's having dialogue scenes where she looks horrific. I'm like, man, people are going to spot this movie a mile away. But it's so weird, because when you have a character in makeup and she's talking and she's interacting and she's going about her life trying to hide what's happening to her, it almost like subconsciously takes your mind off the fact that she's becoming a zombie, because you're focused on what she's doing rather than how she looks, and you just kind of chalk how she looks up to just kind of being part of the gross horror element, you know, rather than understanding that it's actually tipping you off to the main narrative.
Right. And now the character herself is sort of a recovering drug addict.
Yes.
And so I felt like you could almost watch it on a level, again, at least until that reveal at the end, you could sort of watch it on a level as a metaphor just for drug addiction. And so as I'm watching it the first time, I'm trying to piece all these things together, because there's scenes where characters are talking to her and it's obvious that she's all fucked up looking, but they're not really saying anything. And some of that, I think, is kind of funny, just a comment on, you know, sort of polite society. And then some of it I thought, well, how much of this are we supposed to sort of take as just more of a metaphor for drug addiction, that maybe she doesn't look as fucked up as we see her looking, you know? And again, this is all just going through my head until we get to the end. And it's like, no, this was playing it straight the whole time. She really is this fucked up.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a really interesting character detail. How did you kind of come to that, the drug addiction, or even the sort of the fluid sexuality that she sort of expresses?
You know, it really just came from wanting her to be as flawed and real as possible, you know, because we watch these movies so often where the characters are so, I don't want to say cookie cutter, but especially in a genre film, you can get very stock and archetypical characters, you know.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of a bummer, you know, because it's like I'm a big fan of, you know, movies that have great characters. And it's like, I don't want to have to go watch like an award-winning drama just to get good character work. So for me, the idea was really to, you know, stack all the odds against her favor, you know, as much as possible, because for me, that's what's going to make it more horrific. Like some people watch this movie and they absolutely sympathize for her, you know, and they feel that she's just kind of, you know, at a low point in life. And then some people watch it and they absolutely hate her character and they're like, oh, she's completely unsympathetic and this and that. And honestly, for me, I'm fine with both answers or both opinions, you know, because I didn't want to make a cookie cutter film where you know who this character is. For me, I wanted that line to be blurred, where you don't know if you should feel bad for her or if you're pissed off at her because she's making such stupid decisions, you know.
Right.
So for me, that made it so much more real, because, you know, most of us know people who have been at a bad point in their life or who have gone through some struggles, and it's like, you know, the people around this main character all have their own motives. You know, Riley's obviously had a crush on her for a long time, and her best friend secretly has a crush on her and doesn't want her to be with her girlfriend. And her mom wants her to kind of live this straight-laced life because her mom's kind of, you know, overbearing with her own religion. And we even hint at the idea that she may have had her own demons with addiction and alcoholism and, you know, stuff like that in the past. So it's like everyone kind of has their own ulterior motive for Samantha's character, but you don't know if they're actually trying to help her or if that's it. They have their own ulterior motive for which they want her all to themselves, essentially, you know? So it's like everyone in this character is kind of, you know, a blurry line. And for me, that's what this whole movie was about, was just blurring the line as much as possible, because that's how real life is. You know, there's very little black and white in real life. So I just wanted to play it as real as possible so that, you know, even if you don't know someone like this person, you can understand that she's a real person, because none of us are perfect.
Right. I'm amazed as I watched, as I rewatched the last scene of the movie again last night. You know, I see a lot of movies. I see a lot of horror movies. I love horror movies, obviously. And like you said, there's kind of a sameness that starts to creep into a lot of them. So I so appreciate when one comes along and does things differently. And so often I feel like, especially, you know, at the end of a summer movie season, we all kind of complain that movies are all feeling the same and they're all, every movie is just this one thing.
Yeah.
And the last scene of this movie to me, where I really thought, boy, this movie just totally fucking nails it, is that there's so much going on in the last scene. It's this crazy roller coaster, and not to, you know, suck off the movie too hard. I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but like,
very rarely does someone suck off my movie. So.
But we have the scene where her and Riley are starting to get it on.
Yeah.
And so that's horrifying, obviously, because there's maggots coming out of her. And at the same time, it's this weird black comedy because it's sort of this commentary on just how much guys are willing to overlook
to
have sex with a girl. And he's saying these things like, oh, it's tingly and you're really wet. And we have the skeeves because we know what's going on and it's so gross.
Yeah.
So in that scene, it's kind of funny and disturbing. And then, you know, 90 seconds later, I find it really sad when she's driving away and remembering talking to her mom and sort of regretting the way that she had treated her. I found that so moving and sad. And then another 90 seconds later, it becomes this zombie movie and then it's over. And it's just, I've gone through all of these things. And I so appreciate the fact that the movie can be all of those things at once instead of just this or just this.
Cool. I appreciate that. I appreciate that you picked up on all those subtleties. One, it sounds like you really paid attention, which I appreciate, which, like I said, goes overlooked a lot, you know, because I'm a big fan of subtlety, and sometimes you kind of salt and pepper these little details in there that a lot of people miss. So I appreciate you picking up on that. But yeah, the ending in the film is really a roller coaster. Like, if you watch that final scene after the car accident, it's actually all shot in one take. So there's no cuts, there's no editing, and it's like, it was meant to kind of put you in the perspective of her and understand, like, she's no longer the character you've watched this whole movie. So, like, the shot is completely unaltered, it's all one take, and it goes around her, and you see the car, and you see the people who are trying to, you know, tell her to calm down, and then you see her mom and the police, and it's like, the idea was just supposed to be kind of this, like, sensory overload after the end of humanity, so to speak. And humanity is basically, you know, she's kind of a representation of the you know, of what humanity is. And basically it's just all ended and now it's exposed and she's out in the public. So yeah, it's weird kind of watching her last moments and, like, one, seeing how desperate Riley is, but also how desperate she is, because one, she's desperate for, you know, for intimacy, like just someone close to her that she feels she can be comforted by. And she finds it in the person who was most desperate for her, probably sexually. And, you know, it's like, it's just, there's so much commentary there for, like, you know, crossing boundaries and taking advantage of someone, but she's also taking advantage of him by spreading this disease, essentially. And, you know, it is, there's a lot of stuff happening in the last few minutes of the movie. And I'm glad that you kind of, you know, you one, picked up on it, but two, appreciate it. Cause I know it can be kind of a lot, but it's honestly one of those things where watching it in a movie theater with a bunch of people is one of the most gratifying experiences ever, because there's a lot of gasps and laughs too. I'm glad you picked up on the humor, because a lot of people weren't sure, you know, should we be laughing or what? And it's like, obviously, you know, the dialogue I gave Matt, who plays Riley, to say, you know, it's like, obviously I'm not taking that sex scene very seriously. So it was meant to be humorous. So I think there's a nice roller coaster of emotion going on those last few minutes.
Yeah, it's really cool to see. You know, there's kind of, if there's two major trends right now that I'm a little bit burned out on, it's the zombie movie and the prequel. And somehow you made a movie that sort of exists as both in a really cool, interesting way. I can't get the movie out of my head. I really liked it.
Oh, cool. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And now I have read that it went basically from script to shooting in like 2 months.
Yeah.
How did all that come about?
a really weird process. I first of all, as a filmmaker, I'm extremely proactive. I don't like to wait around. I'm not a very I think one, I just love telling stories and making movies so much that I want to do it as much as possible, even though I'm sure there are people out there who absolutely hate my films. So they're gonna be bummed about that. But for the most part, I get so excited, making a film that when the producers came to me, I hadn't done anything in almost a year, basically. I'd just been writing a lot and trying to get some stuff going. And they came to me and they said, "Listen, we have like no money and we really want to start shooting a movie in the next few months. Like, what can we do?" And I pitched them this idea and they were like, "Wow, that's great. Like, we can get you some money for it. Would you want to make it?" And I was like, "Yeah." And I was like, "But I've played this game. I'd made two features by that point so far." And I basically told them, I was like, "Listen, I like you guys and I trust you a lot, but there's a lot of people who come to me and say, 'Hey, we have money and we want to make a movie,' and it never works out." So I was like, "Really, what I'd like to do is, you don't have a lot of money and I don't want to waste my time. So I was like, if you can kind of show me the money, then I'll write the script and we'll go from there. Like, I'll basically tailor make this screenplay for this budget," because the movie I had in my head was initially a much bigger budget. So I kind of had to pare down the idea to fit the budget and fit in the schedule. And basically, I delivered the first draft. Actually, the movie was announced like publicly on all the websites and everything before I ever finished the script. So like the log line went out and everyone was like, "Oh, cool, girl, has sex and contracts what she thinks is an STD, and it turns out to be something worse. That sounds awesome." And I'm like, "Shit," because like now I have to write a movie that lives up to everyone's expectations. So I literally, the like press release of me doing the movie went out on like March 1st, and I think I delivered the screenplay around like March 14th or something like that. And we actually started rolling cameras on like May 12th or something like that. So yeah, it was a really, really quick process. I did like maybe three or four drafts of the screenplay, and yeah, I was kind of, I wrote it for people that I knew would act in it, and kind of used my friends, and we shot in all of our apartments and all of our, our day job kind of scenarios, and basically just kind of, it's like if Matt Mercer, who like I said plays Riley, he was a co-producer on the film. He was like, "Hey, I used to bartend at this bar in Hollywood, and they'll let us shoot there in their off hours." I'm like, "Great, we're dressing that as the cafe for this scene," and so I was just basically assembling the movie as I went along, and thankfully I had such a solid grasp on the narrative and what I knew. When you think of it as like a girl who has sex and then turned into a zombie, it's like it's a pretty straightforward line in terms of your narrative. You know what I'm saying? So really, the biggest challenges were just finding the right kind of sub characters and subplots to kind of just travel through while you're on your way to that end spot. So luckily I had some flexibility there, but it was really just kind of a cobbled together movie. There were a lot of times where I was like, "Wow, it doesn't really feel like we're making a movie. We're just kind of we didn't have a lot of money, so it just felt like we were all just kind of spending our free time having fun together."
Right. And did you, I mean, how does making a movie sort of under those circumstances compare to past experiences where maybe you had a little bit more time, a little bit more freedom? I mean, did you like kind of that run and gun approach? Or is it like something, yeah, every once in a while that's cool, but let's not make that the norm?
It's funny. I think "let's not make that the norm" is more my agent's answer now, because he obviously wants the bigger paychecks and that, and the bigger budgets, which I do too. That'd be nice. But Contracted actually was the best experience I've had making a movie, simply because we had such little resources. I had full creative control. Even the DVD cover is a poster that I made with a really talented artist. Or I shouldn't say I made. I kind of conceptualized. I came up with the idea of the framing, and it's a shot from the movie. And I had a really talented artist named Zach Palmisano kind of mock it up for us. And we sent it to our sales agent as just kind of like a temporary thing, and that ended up being the DVD cover. So it's crazy how much how much involvement I had with the making of this film, from writing it, shooting it. I was a producer on it. So most I did all the casting myself with Matt Mercer. So it was nice. Like it was nice to have that much freedom, that much control, and then kind of one being trusted. I think was really nice because you know not everyone, especially on an independent film set, you know, there's a lot of questioning of the authority. You know, because it's not like Michael Bay walks on set and you're like, oh, that guy's obviously the director. You know,
right.
There's a lot of proving yourself that has to be done, and you know, it's been nice now that Contracted's come out and it's had success. You know, there's a sense of validation there, you know, at least for other people. And I would even say myself too, because there was a lot of questioning myself on Contracted. Like I said, there were many times where I'm looking at the monitor and I'm seeing this girl in this horrific zombie makeup and I'm like, shit, people are not going to get this movie. So, you know, it was nice that it all worked out, but, I prefer the run and gun kind of mentality. I think even if I had, you know, a $50 million budget, I would still want the smallest crew I could get away with and, you know, hopefully as much control as I could have because, you know, I think, you know, film is a director's medium. And that's not to say that I'm not collaborative. My producers had a lot of input in terms of the writing and, you know, a lot of suggestions and everything. But at the end of the day, that I think that's ultimately what the director's job should be is people are bringing you suggestions and you're kind of picking and choosing what's right for that vision that you want to execute. So it was nice to have Contracted and have that much control over, you know, and like I said, having it be as successful as it's been is also kind of a nice just reassurance that I can trust my gut, you know, and know that it worked out.
Yeah, definitely. When it was maybe going to be a bigger movie or have maybe a little bit bigger of a budget, I mean, can you speak to, you said you had originally conceived it as being a little bit larger in scope. Can you speak at all to what that would have been like or what you had sort of originally conceived?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I kind of envisioned the film as being, are you familiar with Eli Roth's film Hostel?
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of envisioned it being in the vein of that, where it took place in a foreign country, and it was about this girl who goes overseas and ends up sleeping with this random guy that she meets at, you know, at like a club, and over the course of, you know, several days, she's got this disease, and she's in a foreign country, she doesn't speak the language very well, there's a weird healthcare system, so like, it was really more of the setting and the location that was going to change, because I wanted it to take place in kind of a seedier country overseas, and just kind of really play up, especially, you know, overseas, they're not as conservative with their sexuality, you know, so there's a lot of promiscuity over there, and you know, people are just a lot more open and free. And thankfully, you know, LA is kind of similar because it's such a melting pot. So it was, it wasn't a, you know, a big transition in terms of the sexuality, but definitely in terms of kind of, you know, the healthcare side of it, that changed a lot. And also the xenophobia, feeling like a fish out of water and being completely alone in a foreign country, that was definitely different. But that was kind of the main idea, was just setting it in a foreign country and kind of, stacking the odds against her favor even more, so to speak.
Sure. Actually, I while that sounds really cool, actually what I really like that it ended up being shot in LA, and I like how bright LA looks, and so much of the movie takes place in the daytime and sort of really kind of pristine, you know, the restaurant, everything is sort of really nice and glossy and pristine looking because I love the way that sort of contradicts or counteracts against this girl who's, you know, rotting in broad daylight. That's really cool. You had mentioned the poster and the DVD cover art, and that's one of those things where I feel like people are going to look at that and have one of two reactions, which is either like, I'm never going to see that because that has upset me, or I gotta fucking watch that right now. And it's been interesting to see, you know, because I follow you on Twitter, and you are Eric_England, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, everybody follow him. I it's so amusing to me that you retweet people talking about the movie, both positive and negative, because you'll get these random people who are just like, oh, I don't understand what the fuck I just saw, and you'll retweet it, and it cracks me up every time. And I feel like, you know, that's to me, that's kind of a sign that the movie is working, not because maybe people don't like it, but because I feel like it's pushing buttons in people and it's making them feel a way that they don't want to feel. And I, you know, with a horror movie, that's the highest compliment you can get.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's funny how many people, you know, what's I think is the most fascinating thing to me is if you search on Twitter just the keywords contracted and movie, it's crazy how many people are tweeting basically the same thing. It's literally almost verbatim the same tweets over and over and over from people around the world, and it's crazy how in sync their thoughts are, you know. And I
The
guess that's a
number
testament.
one being, I'm never going to have sex again, I take
Yeah, a lot of it is. A lot of it's, I'll never look at sex the same way. I never want to have sex again. Or wow, this movie's so weird and disgusting, you know. But you know, I think it's a bittersweet kind of thing because it's like one, it shows me that the movie works in the way I wanted it to,
Yeah.
because they're all kind of having the same chord struck. But also, it shows me that, unfortunately, audiences are paying, you know, the least amount of attention to a movie that they have to
Yeah,
nowadays.
right.
You know, because all they're getting from the film is that it's weird and disgusting. And it's like, obviously, it's weird and disgusting, but there's a lot going on besides that, you know? So that's kind of the unfortunate part. But I think, you know, like that's kind of what my MO is at the moment. And I guess I'm going to have to kind of own up to that, which is I want to make movies that kind of seem on the outside like, oh, they're exploitation films or they're just typical horror films. But when you get deep down into them, it's like, oh, there's more going on here, you know, that people can latch onto. But I definitely think the film has struck a nerve in a lot, you know, basically in the general population, because like I said, the majority of people are having the same responses. And yeah, I mean, I think the types of movies that I love and the types of movies that I want to make are the ones that are polarizing, that people either love or they don't love. You know, like there are actually films that I've seen in the last few years that I didn't actually like that much, that I watched and I had issues with. But whenever people ask me, like, hey, what should I watch or what should I see? Those are usually the first ones that I list, are the movies that kind of pissed me off. And it's because I want to see if those people have the same reaction, you know?
Right.
And I can respect the movie for that it struck a chord in me somewhere. And for me, that's the sign of a good movie, is a movie that's getting under your skin, whether it's psychologically or grossing you out in one way or the other. But I think in relation to Contracted, I think really it's just everyone felt, you know, not to put my movie in the same league as like Nightmare on Elm Street or something, but it's like Nightmare on Elm Street kind of made you afraid of going to sleep when you thought going to sleep was a safe place. And I think Contracted kind of snuck up on people because they were like, oh, we like having sex. And now suddenly I'm kind of slipping in the bed with them and they're like, shit, we don't know if we want you in here.
You know, you had said that people are not really paying attention, and I'm sure a lot of that just has to do with, unfortunately, our collective attention span as a country nowadays.
Oh, absolutely.
And Netflix is awesome. You know, the fact that the movie is on Netflix is great because
Yeah.
obviously it's getting it to a whole bunch of new people. But I wonder also, because Netflix is such this weird ephemeral, that people don't pay as close attention to it, because it's like I put this movie on and I can ignore it, and then right after I can put another one on. That movies are sort of disposable under that model. Again, only with certain people. I don't think everybody treats them that way, because I won't put on a movie on Netflix just to ignore it. But I feel like the this is a totally different conversation, obviously, but the sort of the streaming mentality is making people not pay as close attention as they used to.
Absolutely. I mean, Netflix has almost become like the cinematic equivalent of YouTube.
Yeah.
So, you know, for a lot of people, you know, unfortunately, I think you and I are in the minority where we appreciate film as an art form, and most people who can afford $8 a month kind of look at it as YouTube for their TV, you know, and they just pop on a movie or a TV show or what have you, or a documentary. And just let it run, and they catch bits and pieces of it, you know, because most of the people who are tweeting about Contracted are in the demographic of 14 to, you know, 28 or something like that, and you know, they're of the younger generation, which I fall into that category myself. I just turned 26, so it's like I totally understand that mentality, even though I didn't grow up with a cell phone, you know. But I you know, even now my attention span is much shorter, and you know, it's harder for me to commit to something. I find myself watching less and less films, mainly because, you know, the workload has picked up, but also because you know, it's like I understand that You know, it's harder to find good movies these days. And, you know, it's like if I'm feeling that way as a filmmaker, someone who appreciates the art form probably to the highest degree, I can only imagine what, you know, my little sister who's just out of high school, how she feels. And, you know, and that's a great gauge for me because I see how she reacts to movies and I see how she, you know, dedicates time and attention to certain things. So I'm fully aware that, you know, people aren't paying as close attention as I want them to or as they possibly should be. But, you know, like you said, it's kind of in the zeitgeist that we don't have to. You know, it's $8 a month and, you know, it's less of a commitment, especially a financial one. Whereas like if you go to the movie theater, you're sitting in that movie theater and you've paid your, you know, $10 or whatever it is to watch that one movie for an hour and a half or 2 hours. So, you know, in the movie theater, contracted play is incredible, but I'm sure in someone's house while they're like, you know, cooking dinner and talking to their friends and stuff, it's like they're only getting the gross moments, you know? So I totally understand where that's coming from. And unfortunately, I think that's going to continue to take a toll, not only on my work, but the work in general. I think, you know, especially for Hollywood, like Hollywood understands that they make a shit ton of money at the box office with these films, but they also understand that their films are going to Netflix, to Redbox, et cetera, et cetera. And they're going to be in the homes of American audiences and audiences around the world. So they have to knock over as many buildings as they can, and they have to have as many, you know, Scarlett Johansson's and tight outfits and, you know, superheroes saving the day. So that's what they're doing, is they're going to all these exploitable elements that they can so that people don't have to pay as close attention and they can just get the bits and pieces and feel like they've seen the film, you know?
Yeah. I'm amazed too at reading some of the reaction where some of the people maybe who weren't paying as close of attention talk about, you know, how gross the movie is.
Yeah.
Which I don't think it's super gross. I think,
no, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've picked your moments.
Yeah.
And again, I think that speaks to just really knowing what you're doing and pushing the right buttons. Because, you know, the shot of the blood in the toilet probably gets me more than anything. And that's blood in a toilet. That's just,
yeah,
you know, that kind of works on your head and your stomach. But it's not gratuitous. It's not gory.
Yeah.
There's a few, you know, kind of set piece shots or sequences, but I never did I feel like it crossed a line at all in terms of violence or gore.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of people who are saying Contracted's the most disgusting film I've ever seen, and, you know, it's the nastiest movie I've ever seen. Like, there are people who are saying it's grosser than The Human Centipede, and that's a movie about people's mouths that are sewed to other people's assholes. Like, I mean,
that's what this movie was missing. See, I knew.
Exactly. So, you know, it's weird that people kind of throw it in that vein. You know, I've had people compare it to a Serbian film, and honestly, I know, right? I was like, he sodomizes a child, his own child in that film. Come on. Spoiler alert again, but you know, I guess I have to try and find the silver lining, because in my head, I want to believe that people really don't think that this film is or they really don't, you know, acknowledge the film as that gross and disturbing, but it just had that effect on them. You know what I'm saying? Because I can tell you right now, we did not have the budget that the Human Centipede, probably their effects budget was bigger than our budget for our entire film. So, you know, it's like I want to believe that they're just getting that guttural reaction, kind of like the original Halloween or the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where it feels so much more violent and visceral than it actually is when you go back
exactly
and watch it. You know, I'm hoping it's kind of a psychological effect, but it is weird how people, you know, I think that's what it is their brains are kind of filling in the gaps, you know, because even I definitely know people aren't watching the movie or, you know, God forbid, people are just way more ignorant than I give them credit for. Because I have people, you know, send me messages on Facebook or shoot me tweets where they're like, "So what happened at the end of the movie? Is she like possessed or like, you know?" And I'm like, "Really? Did we watch the same movie? Because like all the context clues are there for you to draw a conclusion. Like I didn't spell it out for you, but the hints are there if you pay attention."
Yeah, I found myself too rewatching it. Yeah, and you're absolutely right about filling in the gaps, because think about, you know, that last scene where you cut to maggots on the floor and we can all figure out where they came from, but it's not like you showed maggots crawling out of a vagina, which would be gratuitous and disgusting, you know, but it's like, no, it's just the implication is there. And yeah, we're all disturbed by it because that means it's working. But when I was rewatching it yesterday, I found myself, I mean, the makeup in the movie is incredible, and Najara Townsend's performance is incredible, and those kinds of things. I don't want to say go without saying, because obviously they deserve to be said, but
yeah, absolutely.
The makeup is really cool, and I found myself, as I was rewatching it, the thing that affected me most the second time was that her hair is just starting to gray.
Yeah.
And that was so fucked up. I thought that was such a cool detail, because again, it's this idea of dying from the inside out, and her hair is just going, I don't know, that shook me more than even, you know, the bloody eyes and all that stuff kind of fucked me up the first time, but this time I was really stuck on the graying hair.
Yeah, you know what's funny is, I mean, I directed the film, and there's times where I watch it and I'm like, I'm even kind of like drawn in, and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of like detail going on here. Yeah. You know, our makeup artist Mayera is incredible. She did a great job and literally had no budget, and we worked really closely on designing kind of Najara's look and understanding like everything had a reason. You know, like I said, nothing was to be gratuitous or arbitrary for any reason. Everything had a reason and kind of you know, a starting point in terms of the evolution of her character. So it's there are times where I see stills from the movie, or one of my favorite things now is you know, I think this just kind of happens when you kind of get into pop culture, so to speak, especially with the internet. They start making little GIF files of your movie, where they're like action, you know, animated pictures, and like Najara's got these like thousands of fan sites devoted to her, and like fake Twitter accounts, and like it's all very unique and kind of interesting. And I'm probably gonna make a horror movie about that someday. But but you know, it's interesting to see like people repost just screen grabs on you know, on Instagram or on Tumblr or something, and then I'll look at the screen grab and I'm like, wow, that's from my movie. Like it looks. It's just crazy how like, you know, I don't know. It's just there's something so like, you know, cinematic about the way she looks. You know, it's like it's very striking. You know, it just kind of jumps out at you. And I know what you're saying. Like seeing the gray hair and all the little detail, and like even if you kind of watch the veins, all the veins on her face, they're not just arbitrary veins. Like they all come from something. Like they all tell. Like there's a weird little story that's being told by all the little you know, deficiencies in her face. So it really is kind of a unique thing. And more credit goes out to Mayera for her incredible job on that makeup, because it really is. It's more than I ever could have asked for.
That's so cool. You gotta explain one scene for me. Not that I, you know, I feel guilty asking a filmmaker to explain.
No,
scene.
No.
They're sitting in the restaurant the first time she and Nikki are sitting in the restaurant, and the guy comes up who I thought Phil told me is John Candy's son.
Yes, yeah, John Candy's son, actually.
Okay, so John Candy's son comes over and says, right. Do I know you from somewhere? And they kind of brush him off.
Yeah.
What? I mean, the first time I was watching it again, not knowing that it's sort of going towards a zombie thing yet, and just not quite knowing, is this all a metaphor? Is she going crazy? You know, because it's fairly early in the film, and so all these ideas are in my head as to what's actually going on. And that scene was so effective to me because, again, so much of the movie to me plays like a waking nightmare where you're all fucked up and nobody's noticing and nobody's actually paying attention to you. And then this guy comes. It felt like a scene out of a David Lynch movie. That's kind of how it shook me up.
Okay.
But what is going on in that scene?
Once again, it's blurring the line. If you actually go back to the party scene, and do you remember the moment where Charlie Kuntz, who plays Zane's character, is introduced?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. You remember Najara's character walks up to him and he's in the middle of like telling a joke or something, and he turns around to talk to her?
Yes.
Yeah. He's actually talking to that guy.
Oh, see, now I sound like the guy who wasn't paying attention.
No. It's okay. It's very, very, very subtle. I think there's maybe like, you know, you see him over Charlie's shoulder. You see him in that one shot, you know, where we establish where Charlie's character is. But it's a very subtle detail that I had at the last minute by asking him to come be in the thing. But honestly, the intention of that scene was really just to I've probably done this too much. I've had people kind of criticize me for it. But just to emphasize Nikki's character of just being kind of this very, you know, pro female like man hater, you know, of like, wow, of course two women are sitting at a table and this guy would come up and try to hit on her by using the old like, have I seen you somewhere, do I know you from somewhere, but the joke's on her because he actually has seen her from somewhere,
right,
you know,
right.
So So it was really just more playing on the idea of like I said, reinforcing who Nikki's character is to her and establishing a sort of dominance over her, how she kind of speaks for Najara's character in that moment. And Najara is kind of like lets her take the lead. So it's just more of like a character moment for both of them. But it has a nice little tie-in if you watch the movie with a microscope.
Now you said you just turned 26.
Yeah.
And you've already directed 3 features.
Yes, sir.
And a couple shorts, and you had the segment in Chilling Visions.
Yeah, let's not talk about that though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had a weird experience on that. I mean, the short version of that is they asked me to do a segment in an anthology, and I really liked the people involved, and I was really excited to do it. The idea was really cool, but at the last minute, I don't know if they just decided that they had too much on their slate and they decided to rush it or what was happening, but they let me write the script with very little influence. And then they tried to have a lot of influence on the casting, which was really unfortunate. And then when it came time to shoot, I got very little time to prep. It was just kind of a very like thrown together kind of production. And shooting actually went really smoothly, like once we were on set. And then after that, I actually had no involvement whatsoever with the film. I didn't get to edit it. I didn't get to do the sound or the music, which I'm actually very, very heavily involved in post-production of my films because, you know, I that's the director's job, period, is to see the film through. But also, you know, audio is more than half the experience, especially on a low budget film where you don't get the money to show everything that you want. You really have to sell a lot of your story and sound. So, I didn't get to finish that movie essentially. Like I wrote the screenplay and I shot the footage on set, but past that I didn't get to, assemble the final story, which editing is in a lot of ways the final rewrite. So, it was tough. I basically witnessed that movie for the first time, you know, with an audience and I asked to have my name taken off because, you know, it's not my movie. You know, right. I didn't finish it. So, you know, it's like if David Fincher directed a film and then, what's his name? Terrence Malick or something edited it. Like, it's not going to be the same movie, you know? So
I would totally see that movie.
Yeah, exactly. I would too. but unfortunately, they didn't have Terrence Malick edit my movie. So yeah, I unfortunately it sucks too because a lot of people have just researching me based on Contracted. They're like, oh, cool, Chilling Visions, and they'll go watch it, and then they're like, what the fuck happened in this sequence? You know, because it's kind of a mess of a short film.
It's got really cool. I mean, the movie, you know, I felt like was uneven, which is true of all anthologies. But your the one that isn't quite yours, really jumped out at me as being the most distinct because I thought it had some really cool stuff in it and it was really kind of fucked up. I didn't totally understand it, but
yeah, exactly. That's where storytelling comes in.
But, yeah, right. Oh, that.
I'm very proud of like the visuals, you know, because like I said, I definitely shot the footage with my Contracted DP, and I had all the ideas for like the cool Jaws and yeah. You know, all the metaphors for taste and all that stuff. So it was a really cool idea that I was really excited about. I just didn't get to see the final execution all the way through. You know, it's like it feels kind of like 40% of my movie.
Right. So how did you know if you've already made, you know, 3 features at 26 plus other stuff, when did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
Really early on, actually. I didn't kind of have a name for it, so to speak, until I was in my teens. But I grew up on genre films. I had really young parents. My mom was 18 and my dad was 21 when they had me. So growing up, when there was a hot new movie at the movie theaters, you know, like Terminator 2 comes out, my dad wanted to go see it and he had to bring me along because we didn't have a babysitter or anything. So, so I got exposed to a lot of really cool movies at an early age. And then growing up, you know, I started to understand that the movies were affecting people in the same way that it was affecting me. So whenever I would get scared, I realized that other people were scared. And there was a cool kind of, you know, piecing that together for me as a young kid was really interesting, and understanding kind of that, just that equation of how that works and the outcome and the result, you know. So I told my parents pretty early on that I wanted to do that. And I kind of gravitated towards storytelling and wanting to be a writer. And you know, one of the biggest factors was I grew up in Arkansas and kind of the Bible Belt, and everything was really taboo. Horror films, raunchy comedy. So when American Pie came out, everyone told me like it was porn. Like you couldn't watch it. Like for all I knew, American Pie was literally triple X penetration, hardcore porn from the way everyone made it sound. So of course I had to see this movie and I sought it out and I snuck into a movie theater or whatever I had to do. And I watched the movie and then I told all my friends about it. And then, you know, when the movie came out on like VHS or whatever at the time, you know, they all snuck down in their basements and watched it or whatever after they kind of like, you know, got their older brother to rent them a copy. And they would tell me, they're like, dude, the movie wasn't as cool as how you described it to me. So, so like, I realized like I kind of had a knack for storytelling and I got, I kind of caught that high of like giving people my version of the movie and having them react to it. So, when it came time to, you know, graduate high school and figure out what I was going to do and go to college and all that stuff, I wanted to be an author and write novels and hopefully have those novels, you know, adapted to the screen. But then when I realized I could just skip all that and actually direct my own films, that's what I really focused all my attention on, was like researching and watching all the special features on DVDs and stuff like that. And I moved to LA a year after high school when I was 19. And then I made my first movie when I was like 21. So it was really just kind of you know, a full speed ahead, no looking back kind of process.
Wow. And so you kind of bypassed film school and all that?
No, no, I did go to film school. That was kind of the gap between 19 and 21. 19 and 20, I was in film school. I went to film school for 11 months in LA. And I kind of bypassed it because I didn't really learn much in film school. Like I learned kind of the process of how to make films, but I didn't learn how, you know, I learned how films were made, not how to make a film, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So, you know, they explained to us how, you know, how Universal and DreamWorks and how all those companies and studios, how they acquire material and how they do deals and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when we would do student projects, our directing teachers would give us tips on how to shoot scenes, et cetera. And a lot of those, you know, student projects all look the same. And for me, that was the biggest red flag, because I'm like, no, we're all individual people. Like all of these short films should be completely different. Like every time someone's sitting at a table eating dinner, like it shouldn't be shot the exact same way that everyone else shoots it, you know? So that was really a big red flag for me. And thankfully, I've always kind of been the type of personality that questions everything. And the moment you tell me I can't do something, I'm usually going to go do it. So, you know, in film school, they were like, no, you can't make a movie with no money. You can't, you know, you're going to be 30 by the time you make your first movie. And I was like, fuck not, you know, like, I'll bet you I'm not. So, I told them, I was like, I want to make a movie as soon as I get out of film school. And none of my teachers really took me seriously. Like, they were all like, you really need to hone your craft and refine things. And they were absolutely right. You know, like the first movie I made, technically I made four feature films, because I made a feature film called Hostile Encounter when I was 21. And I made it entirely on my own money. And I kind of just invested in myself because I knew no one would give me money at 21 to make a real movie unless I showed them something, you know, that would kind of reassure them that I knew what I was talking about.
Right.
So I shot a movie in 5 days for like $3,500 with my friends. We had like a 5-person crew. And basically the movie was just a very simple film that centered around one guy. But, you know, what that did was that showed my friends and all my family and you know, my potential investors who eventually invested in my first film, Madison County, that I knew how to tell a story and that I was competent enough to go from A to Z and do it, you know. So basically what all they had to do was say, hey, what if we give you more? Could you do bigger and better? And then we could sell the movie. And, you know, we made Madison County, and Madison County was relatively successful and, you know, got a really solid release and made some money. And you know, from there, it just kind of took off.
That's amazing. And so when you go into investors or producers to get Madison County made, you know, you show them the movie that you made, but do you also have to come in with like super detailed storyboards? I mean, do you come in basically with the movie already made, just not shot? Is that kind of how you work, where everything's really planned out ahead of time, or how does that work?
It really depends. It's kind of a case by case basis. You know, for Madison County, it took me like almost a year and a half to get the movie financed, because I wrote the film right after film school, and I didn't shoot it until I was 22, and I graduated film school when I was 20. So, you know, Hustle Encounter was kind of my showreel, so to speak, for the film. Like, hey, look what I did with nothing. Here's the script for my next movie. You know I can tell this story. I shot it at my grandfather's house. So basically it was just minimizing the risk as much as possible and showing them that I could do it for as cheap as possible, you know, and I even deferred any sort of payment on it. I was like, listen, I'll direct it for free. Like, you know, all I want is the money to make the movie. And, it worked. I shot the opening scene from the movie with, the producer and one of the stars. And that was ultimately what kind of sealed the deal, was just showing them that opening scene. We shot it like an hour outside of LA, and we shot the actual movie in Arkansas. But, you know, showing them that scene that we shot for like $50, and it was actually, you know, it was really cool. Like, they were like, wow, you shot this for $50? Like, this feels like a movie. And, actually part of that was we released that one scene online, and a lot of the genre websites like Bloody Disgusting and all those guys, they picked up the clip and ran it as an actual trailer, you know, which wasn't correct information, but we weren't going to, you know, tell them no.
Right.
So basically they were touting it as like, oh, this is the trailer for this new movie called Madison County. And we had distributors and foreign companies contacting me and sending me emails saying, hey, we want to buy your movie based off that little 2-minute thing we shot for $50. So we knew if we could get that off of that little thing, that when we made the actual film, you know, we'd be in great shape. And right. We were. Like, the trailer for Madison County was killer and opened up a lot of doors, and the movie did really well for us. And, you know, so it was really cool. But I went through 9 different investors or producers who said they had money on Madison County. So, you know, it was a long process, because one producer would want storyboards, another producer would want a rewrite on the script, another producer wanted talent attached. So the movie kind of constantly evolved as it went along. And now, you know, as I'm starting to deal in kind of the studio world and you know, that kind of thing, like, that stuff works for that world. But still independently, like, independent films are supposed to be just that. They're independent. They don't have someone who's sitting behind a desk all day raking in a paycheck to talk about movies, financing them, you know. So for me, I look at independent film as kind of this punk rock mentality, where it's like, I don't want to make an independent film before I go make it, if that makes sense. You know, sure. It's like, I don't want to, you know, draw up all the storyboards. I don't want to know every single frame of it. Because then, like, that's half the fun, is kind of discovering what your movie is, because you don't have the money to paint the walls the color you want and all that stuff already. You know, it's like when David Fincher walks onto a movie set, and he's one of my favorite filmmakers, so I understand all of his process and I've read a lot about what he does. But, you know, when he walks onto set, the walls are painted the exact color that he wants. Every prop down to the smallest detail is exactly what he wants it to be. And he has the camera and storyboards and animatics and all this stuff. And literally, it's almost like, you know, a military, you know, experience, where they have everything so regimented to the last detail that basically, you know, it's just making sure that everything, it's a well-oiled machine, making sure it all runs according to plan, which is really cool when you have $50 million. But, you know, it's like, if you don't have $50 million and you're making a movie for well under $1 million, it's like, I like that sense of risk, you know, so to speak. And that sense of adventure and, you know, just, I feel like it's such an organic process that I want to discover things as I'm going. So right. I basically have my screenplay, you know, I give them my vision. I'll type it out if I need to. I'll use, you know, visual references and say, this is what I have. These are pictures that I took, or, you know, it's like, I give them enough to understand kind of, you know, the menu, so to speak, of what I'm going to be delivering. But it's like, when the food hits the plate, you know, and is delivered to the table, I want that to be, as unique and fresh an experience as it possibly can be. And, you know, I think that's what's fun. I actually did an exercise recently where I was asked by a studio to deliver a writing sample. They were interested in me writing a screenplay for them, for someone else to direct. And I turned in a sample from Contracted, and just as a little, you know, bonus, I sent them a clip from the movie that, you know, that was actually that clip from the script. And it was so unique to kind of read the screenplay after having not read it for, you know, almost 2 years now, you know, reading that script, that scene, and then watching the actual finished scene from the film, and just seeing how much more textured and detailed it is, you know, on the screen as opposed to on the page. And for me, that's how it's always going to be. Is like you really just kind of have to trust your filmmaker, and if you don't trust your filmmaker, then don't make the movie, you know?
Yeah. Did you know that you always wanted to make horror films?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, growing up, I was exposed to a lot of, not necessarily genre films. Like, I watched a lot of horror films, but I was just exposed to R-rated films in general. I can remember watching, like, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction at a very early age, and, like, Desperado. So I watched a lot of action films and just a lot of dark movies, like Tim Burton films and stuff like that. And I think, like I said, growing up in the Bible Belt, that kind of molded me to be prepared sort of for, this taboo mentality of like, oh no, that's wrong, or that's bad, or that's forbidden, you know? And it's like, for me, I love that sense of doing something that I wasn't supposed to be doing. And I think I kind of get this weird twisted high off of it, because I know the whole time we were making Contracted, I'm like, oh shit, like, we're gonna piss a lot of people off with this. You know, it kind of, I think, translated naturally.
And what is there like a filmmaker, a horror filmmaker, or just any filmmaker in any genre, whose career you look at and kind of say, yeah, I'd kind of like to have his career or her career? Obviously, you know, ultimately you want to have your career, but yeah. Is there anybody that you see and just like, oh, I really like the way this person kind of does it?
You know, I wouldn't say there's one person, but there are several that I really admire. You know, it's like, I really respect, first of all, like, I would say Alfred Hitchcock has probably had the biggest influence on my filmmaking, simply out of the subtlety and attention to detail his films have. I think that's translated a lot in my films. And more than anything, there are subtle homages to all of his films and all of my work. So I think that's naturally crept in. I definitely like how he's respected. You know, it's like even recently they said the greatest film of all time in the general public consciousness is Vertigo, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like I like that he's considered kind of ahead of his time, you know, and even some of his you know, even some of his films that didn't do as well upon initial release are now classics, you know. So there's a little bit of that, and then there's a little bit of, you know, John Carpenter with like the consistency of how many great films he has to his resume, you know. And I think every filmmaker, like, you kind of, I think every filmmaker wants to have kind of that that perfect filmography where they have no blemishes on their record. But it's like every filmmaker has, you know, I don't want to say a bad film, because that's all about perspective and opinion, but mm-hmm. Every filmmaker has that film that, you know, that didn't connect with the audience the way they wanted to. You know, Hitchcock directed like 60 movies or something like that, you know, and he's remembered for like 10 or less, you know.
Right.
So it's like everyone has those, and you know, even Tarantino has, you know, Death Proof, you know, which some people love and some people think is a piece of shit. And you know, even Fincher has Aliens 3, you know. So it's just like everyone kind of has that movie. But I'm a big David Fincher fan. I love the way he has his career. I love that, you know, it's a David Fincher film. I think that's really cool. You know, it's weird. I don't love all of his movies, but I really like the way Soderbergh operates. Mm-hmm. How he kind of has this nice mix between being able to do comedies and indie films and studio films, and he just seems to kind of have a grasp on, you know, playing by his own rules. And essentially, I think that's what I want to do. Is I just want to have a career where I can kind of play by my own rules and, you know, do as many different types of films as I want, at all different sizes and all different, you know, formats. Like, I love that, you know, he did Behind the Candelabra as a feature film and then couldn't find a place for it, so he just sold it to HBO, and now it's a TV movie. But it's one of the best TV movies that's come out in a long time. And, you know, the guy who directed, you know, the movie about Liberace also directed Side Effects, which I thought was a really tight, taut little thriller. And then that same guy who directed that weird, you know, prescription drug movie also directed Magic Mike about strippers, you know, with the same actor, you know. So just showing that kind of range, I think is really unique. And that's something I'd like to do.
And I'm sure as a horror filmmaker, predominantly right now anyway, that you have been asked or approached or whatever to sequelize some of your movies. I'm sure you've been approached about Madison County. I'm guessing somebody will eventually, if they haven't already, approach you about sequelizing Contracted. Is that something that you think you'll eventually do, or do you kind of want to keep making different kinds of movies?
You know, I think everything comes down to balance. You know, it's like the side of me that likes paying bills would love to, make sequels and have money coming in, which is great. But there's also the side of me that I don't necessarily want to revisit the same thing again too quickly, you know, if at all, if I don't have to. But with Contracted, I told them, you know, because they approached me pretty early on, because the movie, upon release, the movie was getting great reviews before it was released. And then when it came out in theaters and on VOD, it did pretty well. And they started talking about it very quickly. So I kind of held them off, honestly, because the movie came out in November of last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really didn't start even entertaining it until a few weeks ago, almost a month ago. So, I kind of held them off for a little bit and told them I wasn't interested in doing it unless I could come up with an idea on how to expand upon it in a way that, one, felt fresh and unique, but two, that excited me, because I didn't want to do the same movie over. And I certainly didn't want to shit on what I had established, because I certainly didn't make Contracted with the idea of doing a sequel, I think that's very obvious from how, you know, it's funny because a lot of people say, oh, you ended it with so many, you know, unanswered questions, but that's really just my style. I want you to continue the story or answer those questions in your head on the way home. So a lot of people, you know, I think personally, from my own personal standpoint, when you look at the film, I didn't plan to do a sequel just based on how I ended the film, with her attacking, you know, her mother and saying, okay, great, this is the outbreak, this is how World War Z and, you know, Dawn of the Dead and how all these other movies that we've seen over the decades start. Night of the Living Dead, this is how Night of the Living Dead starts, you know. So that was my, you know, initial intent, but obviously now, you know, that's being fudged with. So I have ideas, and I think as long as I can do something that, one, feels unique to me as a storyteller, and it's something that I can do something really cool with and something that's going to excite audiences, that's when I'll do it, you know. But, I mean, for the most part, I have no interest in watering myself down. So as long as I can do something that's bold and edgy and is going to stir the pot a little more in the best way possible, I'm down.
Yeah, that's awesome. What is the status of Roadside? I know it's played at festivals. Did it play at Cine Mayhem last year?
It did.
Okay.
It did.
I'm Heather's a friend of mine. She's been on the show a couple times.
Yeah, she's great.
So, but I was trying to find it because I want to see it, and I haven't been able to find it. Is it coming out? Is it already out and I missed it?
No, it's on its way out. I'm not sure when or how or, you know, all the details. But basically the story with Roadside was I made it in between Contracted and Madison County. And it's a film that is more of a straightforward thriller, very Hitchcockian, doesn't have exploitation elements in it. It's just really just a dramatic thriller. Two people held hostage on the side of a road by a guy they can't see. And when you do that sort of movie, you really need at least the business side of the equation needs a marketable face, or they need a name or what have you, to get the movie out there in the public. They need someone's face to put on the poster, so to speak. And even Contracted, if it wasn't the film it was, Najara's face on the poster alone wouldn't sell that film. It's because her face is so fucked up. Like, right, that's right. The selling point, you know. So for Roadside, it was just trickier for them to realize how to market it. So thankfully Contracted did well, and it sparked a lot of interest with people saying, great, you haven't sold this movie yet. It hasn't come out, so what can we do with it? And we got picked up pretty quickly by international sales agents, and they slapped from the director of Contracted on the poster, and they seem to be pretty happy with it so far, with what they're doing overseas. And really, as much as I love, you know, films overseas and you know, all that, like, I want to have the best presence overseas that I can, but the reality is I live here in America, so the American release is what I feel most the closest to and most important about. So really it's just about finding the right home for that film, and finding the people who are going to do the best and most true to that, because the last thing I want is them to slap some bullshit cover on the front of it that doesn't represent the film.
No, and I think that's really cool that you know, you had said it's very much kind of a departure from Madison County, and then Contracted is a departure from that. I'm a fan of like Adam Green, and I really like that between Hatchet and Hatchet 2, he made Frozen, which is a totally different kind of movie.
Yeah.
Because I like, as much as I like being able to, like you said, point to a David Fincher movie and be like, yeah, that's totally a Fincher movie, or John Carpenter, you know, it's John Carpenter just from the fucking font at the beginning. But like,
yeah.
I also like when you can't quite get a handle on a filmmaker, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
So are there things that you think that we could point to as audience members, as sort of students of like auteur theory, and say, this is what makes an Eric Englund film?
I hope so. You know, even with, even with David Fincher, so to speak, you know, it's like you would never believe that the guy who made Fight Club is the guy who directed Seven, you know what I'm saying? Or even the guy who directed, Benjamin Button also directed Zodiac, you know what I'm saying? Or,
right.
Or even, you know, Social Network for that matter. So, you know, for me, it's like, I like that. I like that you can tell it's his aesthetic, but in terms of the types of films he does, he's very versatile.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's kind of the approach I want to take. You know, I think aesthetically you can tell, at least I can, and certain people have pointed it out to me. I tend to use, certain camera techniques a lot. I tend to have similar story elements in my films. All my films have levels of paranoia in them, and I try to get as psychological as possible, but there are little hints here and there. You know, it's all subtle things that I think are unfortunately too intimate to really release into the public, in terms of just like, not that I'm afraid to release them. It's just, I think it's just too much of an inside joke, you know, because like I know people who knew me growing up and they're like, oh, that address they mentioned is like the address you grew up at, or, you know, little things like that. But I think in the grand scheme of things, like, I think as my body of work continues to grow, I think people will notice kind of just visual similarities in certain scenes and how I shoot things. And hopefully they, it's like, I don't want to be so abstract that you can't pinpoint my movies, where
right.
I try to do a total departure. Cause like, you know, I think Spielberg kind of does that. And I actually like that. It's like, you would never guess that the guy who directed Jaws directed like Catch Me If You Can, you know what
right,
I'm saying?
Right,
like,
right, right.
You would never guess that, but somehow they all still, when you look into people who really study Spielberg's filmography, they're like, oh, a lot of his characters have daddy issues, and there's all these nostalgic qualities that you can find in Spielberg's work, and I think hopefully that's what I'll have as well. It's like you kind of have to look a little deeper than the surface, because like with David Fincher's films, I feel like it's really a very surface level connection, you know what I'm saying? It's like
right.
all of his movies kind of have a similar look and a similar aesthetic, and they have this green thing going on, mm-hmm. and it's that's kind of his shtick. But it's like I hopefully have one of those kind of connective tissues that's a little deeper than the surface, and you kind of have to go through my actual filmography, and you know, like I think that's what makes a director like Carpenter so unique, because obviously Carpenter's are very surface level. Like you said, like the font and the anamorphic lenses and the dun-dun, you know, soundtracks. But also he has a lot of connective tissue in his narratives. Like he does a lot of movies with strong male characters, and he does a lot of stuff with like women who are in trouble but also empowered, and you know, so like he's got a lot of recurring themes that I like, and hopefully I think that's what I'm gonna strive to. But ultimately I think the biggest thing is for me, making films or telling stories in general is a very therapeutic process, and not to get too douchey about it, but it's like you really learn a lot about yourself when you make a movie, because it's almost like, you know, vomiting and being like, oh, look what I had for dinner. like that's what was left over.
Right.
Just so much stuff in your life, and then what you actually put out into the world is really a lot of what's in your subconscious, you know. So, you know, who knows, maybe one day we'll look back and we'll see that I have mommy issues or something, I don't know, you know. So I guess we'll see here in a few years.
That's definitely one of those things too, yeah, like you said, that'll kind of come into focus, you know, the larger body of work you have, and the longer you continue to work, you start to see themes that come up again and again. And like you said, they may be things you weren't even aware of. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, all of my movies have this focus on this one thing. And that,
yeah, that like Tarantino, like there's right. a lot of shots of feet in my movie.
Exactly.
I don't really know what that's about.
He's so. Finally, it seems like he's finally kind of copping to that though. Like, yeah, I'm into feet, guys.
Did you see that article? I forgot what magazine it was. I feel like it was like GQ or something, but he was actually wearing like women's heels.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's really unique. Like he's wearing like, you know, a 3-piece suit or something, but like he's wearing like red heel, like 6-inch heels or something. But yeah, I mean, he's definitely owning up to it now. So I'm curious to see. Like, I wonder if the next few years I'll have like maggots falling out of vaginas in my 10 movies.
Man, every one of his movies, they got vagina maggots.
It's crazy. Like, it makes no sense, but somehow it works.
Two more quick questions, and
Let's
then
do
I'll
it.
Let you go. Do you have? I'll ask them together. Do you have a favorite horror movie? And do you have a horror movie that you love that nobody else really does?
Oh, dude, I've got plenty of those. I have a favorite movie of all time,
okay.
which is actually a horror film, and it's Scream, actually. Scream is my absolute favorite movie of all time.
Interesting.
Yeah, for me, it's just got – I mean, it's a very nostalgic thing
sure.
because of the time in my life when I saw it. It was just very influential on me. But also, I've honestly – like, I hate admitting this. I've probably seen that movie 100 times. Like, no shit. Like, 100 times. I've watched it every time it comes on TV that I come across it. I've thrown it on just to watch. I've studied it. I've gone through DVDs. You know what I'm saying? Like,
wow.
I've had to rebuy that movie. So I know every line of the movie. I know every music cue. Like, there's just something about it. Like, I love the writing. I love the shots. I love the directing. I love the performances. I think it's got humor. It's sexy. It's scary. You know, it's smart. Like, it was just so... it's so ahead of its time because it's so relevant, and it kind of started this like snarky, sarcastic mentality that I think has lingered, especially on the internet, you know, for so long.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of how the people are of the world today. Like, we kind of poke fun at everything rather than taking it seriously, you know, and it started that trend of scary movies and spoofs, which I think have really influenced culture in general, you know, and society in general. So it's got all that, but it's also kind of a time capsule, you know. It's like when you watch Scream and you watch that opening sequence with Drew Barrymore, it's like when she goes to pick up the phone with the cord on it, it's like, yeah, it's dated and it feels weird, but it's like you don't ever question it. It's just like, dude, that was how it was at that time, you know. It's
right.
like no caller ID, no cell phone shit, like that's how it was. Like, she picks up that phone and you are instantly terrified all the way back to 1996 all over again, you know. And for me, that's just so cool. Like, I love everything about that film. And in terms of movies that I love that everyone hates, like I said, I probably got way too many. I'm obviously a kid of the 90s, so like I love like the whodunit thrillers. In fact, one of my favorite scripts that I've written is a whodunit thriller. Kind of, you know, it takes like the fun of the 80s horror films with the cool kills and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and mixes it with kind of the thrilling element of the 90s, but adds in kind of the balls of what we're doing in cinema today and what I try to do with Contracted. So it's kind of like three decades of horror all, you know, tossed into one, which I really
nice.
Like.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, the whodunits, I get a lot of shit from, because like I can watch those things over and over and over, because for me, it's like, even if the movies are bad, like if I don't know who the killer is at the end of the movie, like I'm going to watch that whole fucking movie until the end just to find out who the killer is, you know? So like the movie in 2001, Valentine, do you remember that?
I sure do.
Yeah, like I watch that almost every Valentine's Day. that's a huge guilty pleasure of mine. You know, the original Urban Legends. I even like Urban Legends Final Cut, which is a guilty pleasure of mine. And I'm trying to think. I know there's some other ones. Like there's a lot of new ones too that, you know, like I catch a lot of shit for liking Dead Girl, which is weird because a lot of people who like Contracted kind of are like, what, Dead Girl, really? And I'm like, dude, Contracted's totally in the world of Dead Girl. So that's weird. But yeah, I've got a lot of guilty pleasure films that I catch a lot of shit for.
Well, and horror movies are interesting because almost any horror movie you name that you think is shit, like, somebody really loves it. And for years I've had this list of horror movies that I really like that other people maybe don't, and then in recent years, like Scream Factory keeps legitimizing my shit.
Totally.
So like I loved the Funhouse and Life Force and nobody likes them. And then Scream Factory puts them out and it's like, oh, now it's a classic. Okay, now it's okay for me to like
it. Now because it's got a cool cover art and it's on Blu-ray, like everyone's like, oh shit, it's a classic.
Right. So now it's okay for me to like it. But it's like, I fucking like these movies for years, guys. How do you feel about the Scream sequels, just out of curiosity?
You know what? Because I'm such an like unbiased fan or unapologetic fan of the first one, I actually don't mind the sequels. I actually like two a lot. I think they progressively get worse.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny. Like Scream 3 would probably be up there on my list of guilty pleasures because it is such a departure from the series, and the tone is so weird, and it doesn't have Kevin Williamson's stamp all over it. You know, but I still have a lot of fun with it. You know what I'm saying? Like I can still sit down and watch that film all the way through. In fact, the opening sequence I think is brilliant, with Cotton Weary. So I actually really dig the sequels. I hated Scream 4 when I first saw it, and it's grown on me a little bit. It's still not, one of my favorites, but like I said, I think the series just kind of gets worse as it goes on.
Which is probably true of a lot of, franchises, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Like, there are very few, but this is so weird because it's like a Wes Craven thing. Like, I'm not a huge fan of the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels. Like, there are a few here and there. Like, 3 is pretty cool, and I even have a weird soft spot for 2. But I fucking love New Nightmare, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, there are those weird moments where it's like every once in a while a sequel will kind of pop up. And I feel the same way about, like, the Friday the 13th franchise. You know, it's like I love the first one. I think 3 is pretty cool. I really like 4. 5, but then, like, I'm all about, like, Jason Goes to Hell, you know?
Yes.
So, like, I'll randomly have one of these films that kind of pops up out of nowhere. And I'm actually kind of a sequel whore. Like, I really like Creepshow 2. Actually, my favorite franchise of all time is, and it's one that people actually don't really consider a franchise, but it's the Psycho franchise. Like, I love, with no questions asked, all the Psycho sequels. Like, I, for some reason, I'm just so into them.
I don't think I've ever seen, I've seen the first 3, obviously, and I don't think I've ever seen 4 or the TV movie, or was 4 the TV movie?
4 is the TV movie, and
okay.
it's actually really, really great. Like, there's some really cool stuff going on in that film.
Yeah, that's Mick Garris, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably good.
yeah, it's actually well worth watching, I actually saw the Psycho sequels a little later, like probably when I was like in my earlier 20s, and I just fell in love with them, and I've watched them numerous times ever since, and yeah, they're great.
Yeah, Psycho 2 was another one of those movies that for years I was championing, and then Scream Factory put it out, and everybody's like, yeah, Psycho 2 is pretty good. Like,
yeah, exactly. We're in.
Anyway, I will let you go. I can't tell you how much fun this has been and how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Hey, same here, man. I've had a blast. Thank you again for digging the film and asking me to gab about it.
Yes, I cannot wait to see whatever it is you do next, whether it's Roadside or whatever the next movie happens to be. Do you have something in the works right now?
I've got a few things. I'm at that weird phase right now where my next step has to be a very careful one. I've got this really, really awesome script that I just finished writing that I'm hoping to shoot this year called The Sirens. That's a really, really cool movie, and we have a great cast lined up for it. It's a it's unlike anything I've ever seen, and I don't really know much many films that are going to be able to that you're going to really be able to compare to it. But it's a film about a group of deep sea fishermen who have a really successful haul out at sea, and they dock for the off season, and while celebrating kind of their outage at sea. They come across these 4 mysterious young women who are on a mission, and that mission includes using these fishermen in a ritual sacrifice to resurrect their dead lover. And it's a really, really just crazy, intense, fun, and scary movie. And I've also got a screenplay that I didn't write, actually. It'd be my first one if I end up shooting that one soon, that I didn't write, and it's called Hellbent by this really, really incredible writer named TJ Semfel. And basically it's about this accident in this mine, and they send down a search and rescue team to go recover the bodies, and when they get down there, all the bodies are missing. And one of the wives of one of the miners blackmails her way onto the search and rescue team. And when they get down there, they realize that the miners have unearthed these demonic entities and now are possessing people to reach the surface. And it's a really like tight thriller in the vein of like The Exorcist and The Thing, just very intense and genuinely scary. It's the first screenplay I've ever read that gave me goosebumps, so I'm fucking stoked to shoot that one.
Cool, man. I'm in for both, so go ahead and make those, and then you can come back on the podcast and we'll talk about them.
I'm so down, man.
All right, thank you again so much, and best of luck.
Awesome, man. Thank you, and yeah, I appreciate it.
Take care.
All right, you too, man.